Okay, my guest on Podcasting with Sophie this morning is none other, and I'm pleased to finally get to talk to him, C. Courtney Joyner. He's a writer, director, producer, sometimes actor, now times novelist. He's written comics and video games as well. He's the author of the Shotgun Western series. The new one of those is Bushwhacked. Also, Nemo Rising is the new one. He's also the screenwriter from A Whisper to a Scream, Prison, Vietnam, Texas, The Class of 1999, Puppet Master 3, Dr. Mordred, Trances 3, Distant Cousins, Lurking Fear, Veronica 2030, Nautilus, Instinct to Kill, Trances 6, Mega Scorpion, Puppet Master Legacy, Tomb of Terror, which he also directed, along with Trances 3, and what was the other one you directed? Lurking Fear.
Lurking Fear, yeah.
And he's also been a sometime actor. I notice I usually go to IMDb last because it's not terribly accurate sometimes. But it says here that you had a part as a zombie wearing glasses in Dawn of the Dead. Is that true?
That's absolutely true, yes.
Wonderful.
And, after running down my resume, I think that's the highlight.
Yes, totally. I was like, wow. I thought, okay, what did he act in? So I had a look, and I went, wow, Dawn of the Dead, fair dinkum, that's beautiful, marvelous. So tell us about your Dawn of the Dead experience briefly, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, I was raised in Pittsburgh, and so I forget how we all found out that that George Romero needed extras out at the Monroeville Mall, and it was wintertime, and they were shooting out there, and so some friends of mine and I, we went out to the mall, and they were filming stuff for Dawn of the Dead, and God, they were having a terrible time because of the weather getting people to be there consistently. It was also, you know, around the holidays and what have you. So if you volunteered, boy, they really put you to work, and I was interested in makeup and stuff like that, so I actually helped a man named Gary Zeller, who was the special effects guy who was doing the pyro. I helped him out a little bit, and then I remember Richard Rubenstein was painting everybody gray, and we were all kind of, you know, just standing there with like a little factory, and then you would do your little bit as an extra, and if they wanted you to stay around, sometimes they would, you know, put a mustache or something like that on somebody who was there because they couldn't get, you know, multiple people to come out consistently.
Right. Well, that would have been a great experience, certainly a great memory now that George is no longer with us.
Okay. You know, okay, every time I put that picture pops up on Facebook of me with my face against the glass of JCPenney's and everything else. Oh, my gosh, that's the one thing I do that gets the biggest reaction because it's Dawn of the Dead.
Wow. That's tremendous. After the long career you've had and all the great triumphs you yet to achieve, you know, could that be your legacy, I wonder? I don't know.
Oh, my gosh.
It wouldn't be a bad legacy, though. You know, you were a zombie in Dawn of the Dead. I mean, there's people with worse legacies. I mean, you know.
That is true.
You know, there's people that are remembered for horrible things. I mean, look at all the wonderful things Elvis achieved in his life. And, you know, when people say, oh, Elvis, yeah, he died of a heart attack on the toilet.
That's true. So I'll just, I guess I'll just count my blessings.
I'm only mucking around, though. I'm not being serious. Of course, you'll be remembered for everything. But it's not a bad thing that people bring up, though, because George was very good at what he did. To be remembered as part of that little place in cinema history that was cut out by George Romero, I think, is not too shabby at all.
And Dario Argento.
And certainly Dario Argento as well. Yes, another very a master really of his craft. But listen, Courtney, I know who you are. And there's a lot of people that know who you are, but I always try to take into account there's probably a few people out there that don't. So I wonder if you could give us a little bit of an origin story up until the beginning of your career, if you wouldn't mind, sort of a little overview.
Oh, no, I grew up in Pennsylvania. My father was a doctor and was always an intense movie geek. I was very lucky. I grew up in that 1960s, you know, monster boom era, famous monsters and Aurora model kits and Hammer films and all of that great stuff. And and my mother was a writer. She was a newspaper reporter. And so, but I was always, you know, with the Super 8 movies and all that stuff. And also I began the habit in the, when I was about 13 or 14 of starting to write fan letters to movie directors.
Right.
And of course, in those days, it seems like so long ago, I guess it really was. If you wrote a letter to someone like John Sturges or Don Siegel, you actually got a response because, you know, first of all, these guys were not considered celebrities. They weren't considered, you know, they were filmmakers, and I don't want to say they were obscure because they weren't. They were highly regarded, but you had to know your movies and things like that to know who you wanted to address. It wasn't like, you know, writing a letter to the Jackson 5.
Yeah.
And
they weren't regarded the same way as directors are regarded today.
Well, of course, part of the reason being that the exposure to the behind-the-scenes world of filmmaking was still so limited. There are no DVDs, there are no behind-the-scenes featurettes, and those things are so commonplace now.
Right.
And if you did see something like that, that was very unusual, and it was great.
Yes, totally.
But I started to do that, and those guys were always so kind to me and would always write me back and what have you. I actually still have, I was 16, I wrote Don Siegel a letter asking him for a summer job, and I still have his response. It was on telephone stationery.
Awesome.
And I told him how great I thought the shootist was, and he wrote me back this great little letter. He said that he was preparing a Western called I, Tom Horn. William Goldman had written it, and it was going to star Steve McQueen. And Siegel writes me back a letter, and he says he couldn't offer me a summer job because Steve McQueen's entourage was so large there wouldn't be room for me.
Right.
So I actually have a letter from Don Siegel telling me he can't give me a summer job because Steve McQueen won't allow it. So yeah. And it's on Charles Bronson stationery. So,
that's,
you know, I don't think that...
That's wonderful.
It'll ever get better than that.
That's wonderful. I hope it's framed and up on a private place on the wall somewhere.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
That's wonderful.
But that was kind of who, you know, that's really who I was. And I was able, fortunate enough to go to USC and meet like-minded people, and Jeff Burr and Darren Scott and everyone. And we all lived together after college. And when I was at USC, I did a documentary on Sam Peckinpah, and I got to know those guys, Warren Oates and L.Q. Jones, who's, you know, still up very close to him. In fact, I'm seeing him tomorrow. Sam was very nice.
That's wonderful.
To me,
you're
and
seeing,
I got to know
sorry,
Siegel
sorry, don't mean to cut you off. Did you say you're going to see L.Q. Jones tomorrow?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's incredible. Say g'day for me. I love that guy. I really
oh,
do.
He's terrific.
I really do. He reminds me of the guy who replaced sort of Slim Pickens, you know? Like you had your...
LQ, of course, he was a little more wiry and foxy.
And distinctly for the voice, too, like Slim had a real distinct voice, and he could pick it anywhere. But LQ is kind of like the guy who, I feel, my point of view, came along after Slim, and you hear that voice, and you just know who it is. You know, even
well, though, now, and what movie did LQ kill Slim in?
Oh, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, wasn't it?
Absolutely,
yeah.
That's right. Knocking on Evan's door, LQ shoots him in the gut.
Yeah, and he's sitting down by the creek and ooh.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Totally.
I'm going. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was very lucky with that. And in fact, when I was on, I was hanging around the set of Osterman Weekend. I was very fortunate and to be able to do that. And that was the first time I ever encountered Tim Thomerson, because he was there playing a police officer who was also a spy. And then Tim and I got to be fast friends. And, of course, we've made a lot of movies together. And
I love Thomerson. I first saw Tim Thomerson, oddly enough. The movie I have first recollections of seeing him was in a Disney film called The Brat Patrol, where he played a... kind of the second sergeant from the left. He was Brian Keith played the
mm-hmm.
Brian Keith played the general, and
that's right.
Tim Thomerson was like his his assistant, or he was a major underneath him or something like that, you know. And he was the one who was tough on the kids, but also, you know, kind of liked them too, you know. And he's already sort of, and he had that sort of, you know, that sort of smart arsery thing going, but it was kind of like really lighthearted. Because like when he catches Sean Astin,
Tim was, of course, because of his stand-up comedian background.
Yeah.
And Robert Altman really was the one who tagged him to start as an actor.
Really.
And A Wedding and Remember My Name and all of those movies.
Right,
and yeah. I never would have gotten my first chance to direct a movie if it wasn't for him. That's
really, that's
an
fantastic
fact.
And
yeah.
do you still see, I've seen pictures of you online, so do you still you and Tim still keep up?
Oh yeah, I talked to him this morning.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Who are you going to see the day after tomorrow?
Yeah, so we might. He comes over for lunch.
That's fantastic. He's not there now, is he?
Yeah.
I'm going
to... we've been good friends, and he's a real movie buff.
You don't mind if I ring back one time when he's there and I can say g'day, could you?
Absolutely. Well, we'll coordinate that and make it happen.
That would be incredible. I am a huge Trances fan, and just getting off topic for a minute, again, when you talked about writing letters to directors and stuff that you like and asking them for stuff, I kind of did that not long ago with a favorite director of mine who directed one of the Trances films. I believe it was Trances 3. This director named C. Courtney Joyner, who was also a screenwriter.
Good Lord.
And I wrote to him and asked him if he would write a little forward for a novella I was writing, and he wrote me back, and he actually ended up doing it. So there's my...
Oh, well, there you go.
So there's my little Hollywood.
That's very lovely. Well, I'll tell you how the director correspondence kind of semi-backfired.
Okay.
I did a summer school session overseas, and I was able to go to the British Film Institute.
Okay.
I was about 16, 17. I was still in high school. It was like a summer semester. So I actually got to be around Hammer Films a little bit and some stuff. It was really neat. But I had written a letter to Richard Lester.
Right.
Because I just loved his work, and I really wanted to meet him. And, of course, this was right after the 3 and 4 Musketeers and everything.
Right.
And anyway, I never heard from him. And when I got home, there was a big envelope waiting for me. It looked like a deer hide, but it was made out of cardboard. And it was all of this stuff, stills and lobby cards and posters and stuff from Robin and Marion, which he had just finished.
That's cool.
So, it was great. And so I'm reading this letter, and it's like, "Dear Courtney, I'm sorry we missed each other, but I'm back in London now, and here's all this material for my latest film. I'd love to meet you. It would be so great for you to come back, and you could, it would be wonderful to spend time with you. And it's so unusual to hear of a girl who's interested, a young lady who's interested in filmmaking. So because of my name, he thought I was a 16-year-old cheerleader." So I can just imagine Richard Lester's face as he's there at Heathrow, and I come lumbering down the jetway going, "Hey, tell me about Peter Sellers." I think he would be crushingly disappointed, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you still have that letter that says,
yes, I do. That went into the archives. Yeah.
That's great. It'd be nice to meet a girl interested in filmmaking. Oh, my goodness. That's a good one. Oh, that's better than a cup of coffee this morning right now. Oh, goodness. That's fantastic. Oh, wow. You didn't actually get to speak to or introduce yourself to Richard Lester later on.
Yes. In this age of litigiousness, we could say that, he is, he was very innocent, and, we never had any contact at all.
Well, that was nice. He sent you a whole bunch of swag, though, from...
Yeah, he did.
Yeah,
absolutely.
From Robin and Marion, which is a nice little film. I really enjoy that. It's a different type of Sean Connery.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful movie.
Yeah, I think a lot of people I speak to don't really regard it, but I've always enjoyed it because I like those kinds of movies, like those I like to call them what if kinds of movies, like what if Peter Pan grew up and what if Robin Hood retired, you know, what if, you know, it's always interesting because it allows you to show another.
Well, we kind of ended up stumbling to this, but that is literally the thread that kind of got me going with Captain Nemo. It was, honestly, it was taking that step because those are exactly the kinds of movies that had always turned me on. And so, zillions of them do, but I always loved that. I always loved to follow those stories.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of, what lit the fuse a zillion years ago when I started this thing.
Right, totally. So, in amongst all of your credits, you worked a lot with Charlie Band's company.
Oh yeah.
You obviously have a good rapport. How did you two come to know one another? Like you said, Tim was sort of Tim was responsible, and he was part of Charlie's crew early on. Did he bring you into the fold, so to speak? There. Or?
Oh no. I got to know Charlie because of Irwin Yablons. I was hired to write a movie called Prison, and Rennie Harlan was going to direct it. And I was recommended to Irwin by actually a friend of mine from college,
right,
whose dad had been one of the investors in the movie Hell Night. And so I met with Irwin, I showed him some spec scripts, he was then partnered with Bruce Cone Curtis, and they hired me.
Wow.
And Irwin had developed a project. He wanted to do Halloween in prison.
Okay.
Was his idea.
Right.
And he had a script written, but it was prisoners literally being stalked by a guy with a knife. And I said, Irwin, the problem with that is everybody has a knife in prison. This is ridiculous. It's not, no one would be afraid of this.
Yeah.
So I said, it's got to be Poltergeist goes to jail. It has to be supernatural.
Right.
So we really shredded the first script, and I started over again from scratch. And Rennie and I worked closely together. In fact, we ended up being housemates. We moved in together.
Wow.
And then I wrote that script. But Irwin, the original company dissolved, and Irwin had to shop the project around, and we ended up at Empire Pictures. And, of course, he and Charlie had a long history together. And that was how I first met Charlie. But the movie was financed outside of Empire. It was kind of, done like Reanimator was. So it wasn't developed in-house or anything like that. And so it kind of all came from the outside. But I ended up staying at Empire and working with Charlie and Irwin. Of course, I got class in 1999 because he recommended me. And I was over at TWE and Canon because he really was kind of my guardian angel there for a long time. He was my mentor during that phase, absolutely.
Yeah.
But that's how I got to Charlie, was through Irwin.
Awesome. That's wonderful.
And the movie, and they were very happy with the results of the movie, and there we go.
Yeah, totally. But and Flatmates with Rennie Harlan, hey?
Yep.
Wow.
Absolutely.
So what was Rennie like before his blockbuster phase? Was he
actually remarkably the same? We always got along just fine, but you knew that lightning was going to strike. You know, he was this impressive, Norse movie guy. I always said that Rennie got the girls and I got to make the breakfasts.
He's not coming around this time.
This is the way our arrangement worked out.
Yeah, he's not coming around this week too, is he?
No. We've kept in touch. We kind of, he went obviously his own way and enormously successful. And
yeah.
Now he's he's based in China and he's doing very, very well.
Yeah.
And,
cut his hair.
But, you saw, it was interesting because being there during the period, and I did some work on Nightmare on Elm Street with him.
Right.
And we worked on other things. But the thing was, see, being that close to that kind of meteoric explosion, because that's what was going on then, that, Shane Black and the selling spec scripts for zillions of dollars and, all that was all what was happening at that time.
Right,
and, it was something. To really see all that happening up close.
Yeah, it was. But, it was one of the last gold rushes, huh?
It really was. I'll tell you, here's the the classic and typically Hollywood story. Remember the movie Cobra?
Yeah, yeah.
Sylvester Stallone?
Yeah,
okay.
Totally, yeah.
I'd actually been on the set of it because of Andy Robinson. And so, anyway, the film opened, and they had the Cobra-thon at the Chinese theater.
Right.
In Hollywood, where it ran 24 hours.
Right, right.
So Rennie and I decided to go to Cobra-thon.
Right.
And we're scrounging around trying to get the money together to go to the movies. We didn't have any dough. And we got it out of our seat cushions or wherever we got it. We go down to the Chinese theater, and we're standing there, and it's late at night, and it's damp, and it's cold, and we're waiting to go inside. And we got pushed aside by Frank Stallone's security guards.
Right.
And Frank went in. And I later did a movie with Frank, and he's a nice guy.
Right,
so
yeah.
That was fine. But it was like so, I thought, wow, here we go. There goes Frank. And he goes in to see Sly's movie. And how long ago after that did Rennie direct Cliffhanger?
Right, yeah. Wow.
And here we were, yeah, just these wet dogs standing on the sidewalk, and then, you know, so many years later, there he is doing Cliffhanger.
Yeah,
so
wow.
That's kind of definitely the Hollywood lesson there. I'm not quite sure what it is.
Yeah.
There it is.
But yeah, that would have been funny to remember when he met Sly, you know, hey, your brother pushed me out of the way. I was trying to go and see your movie.
Yep.
And I haven't forgotten.
Yes. Now it's just an anecdote.
Yeah.
Because, no ill will.
Because you're going to be hanging off this mount for a long time, my friend. Now it's payback. But fantastic. Well, let's talk about the books, because ironically, that's what I say ironically, because I've spoken with a lot of screenwriters of late, and it seems to be what you're all up to is writing books. Luke, who wrote Explorers, is writing books. Charlie Haas, who wrote Matinee and Gremlins 2, he's writing a book.
Yeah.
Bill Sachs, who did The Incredible Melting Man and Galaxina, he's writing a book. Yeah, you're all writing books. But you're writing some westerns. I love westerns. I love western movies. I love western stories. You've got the Shotgun western series. Bushwhacked is the new one. Is that true?
What Bushwhacked is Kensington decided to put the first two books together as one volume.
Right, okay. Oh, all right, okay. That's the first two.
And so that comes out in January to kind of relaunch the series. And then there will be the third one, which is called These Violent Times.
Right.
That will come out around Labor Day. And then the fourth one is Bullet Kissed. And that one's for 2018. And then we'll see if we can continue. But I'm very gratified. The series has done well. It actually is now a series, and it's done well, and so I'm very pleased about that. Mm.
Well, the other big one you've got coming out.
Enjoy those ranks.
The other one you got, the big one you're coming out soon, December 26th, is Nemo Rising, a sequel to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Ships are being destroyed by monsters off the coast, and the Navy seems helpless, and President Ulysses S. Grant goes and gets out of prison the notorious Captain Nemo and says, "We'll give you a pardon, sir, if you'll help us out." And so he sets sail with the beautiful, she's a beautiful assistant who's also the niece of his chief advisor, but he doesn't know how close the enemy is, apparently. That sounds really cool. That sounds really cool.
Well, thank you very much. It's funny how these things really work out, because this began
It hasn't been optioned as a film yet. Sorry? Oh, yep. It began as a TV pilot?
As a spec TV pilot that I wrote about 17, 18 years ago.
Wow. So it's been a long time coming.
It has been a long time. And the thing was, Universal was doing a thing at the time called the Action Pack.
Okay.
And in fact, that's where Sam Raimi did Hercules.
Okay, all right, okay, I dig it. Right, yep, I know where you are.
So that's how long ago this was,
okay.
And I decided, I said, you know, no one's ever done, I mean, of course we all love, it's kind of that reverse thing where you discover the movies and then you discover the literature. I think that's true for a lot of, certainly science fiction, fantasy, and horror fans. And
right.
So So having seen and loved the Richard Fleischer adaptation of 20,000 Leagues written by Earl Felton and James Mason and Kirk Douglas and everyone.
Yeah,
and,
love that movie.
It's tremendous. And so then, you know, seeing the movie, and then, of course, he got kind of a truncated illustrated edition in school, and I kept kind of pursuing Jules Verne and was fascinated with him and H.G. Wells, and then really Edgar Rice Burroughs and these adventure writers. And I grew up, I was very lucky in that kind of paperback era of Frank Frazetta covers to Conan paperbacks and things.
Yeah.
So you kind of, Neil Adams, Tarzan books and things, so you kind of gravitated towards that stuff.
Yeah.
But as much as I loved 20,000 Leagues, I absolutely adore Mysterious Island.
Yes.
I think it's wonderful. And in fact, I got to know Herbert Lom a little bit, and what a great guy he was. And he was such a wonderful Captain Nemo. And of course, it is the movie, of course, with the Harryhausen creatures and everything, is quite a bit different than the Verne book, which is very close, honestly, to Robinson Crusoe. It's a desert island story.
Yeah. I actually have a buddy who directed a version of Mysterious Island. Russell Mulcahy directed a version.
I remember that.
Gabrielle Anwar and Kyle MacLachlan and Patrick Stewart, I think, plays Nemo in it.
Patrick Stewart is Captain Nemo, sure.
Yeah. But anyway, you were saying?
Verne's book, as you know, his publisher actually asked him to include Nemo in the book.
Right, yeah.
To make it more commercial.
Totally.
And so, you know, then when Columbia finally did the movie, but that thing just had this great impact on me. And I said, you know, that's an approach that hasn't been done to this type of material in a long time. That kind of wonder, that kind of, you know, I wouldn't say innocence, but the rollicking adventure approach to those kinds of stories I hadn't seen in a while, or felt that I hadn't anyway. So I decided to write this TV pilot with this two-fisted Captain Nemo. It's a little on the violent side, which I kind of tend towards. But I wanted to make him kind of this two-fisted guy, not the U-boat commander of James Mason, and maybe not as sophisticated as Herbert Lom, a little more on the Sean Bean side of things.
Yeah.
And he is in prison for the sinking of the USS Abraham Lincoln. And I kind of took it from there. I mean, you know, my God, I mean, you could say, oh, well, Wild Wild West and the television show anyway. And so I just had a ball with it, and then nothing happened. And when I say nothing, I mean, it went out. I had a lot of meeting with the producers. I had just done a film with a director named Bradford May, who had a very big track record directing pilots.
Right.
And Brad was a big TV guy, and he had, at the time, had been directing the Aquaman episodes of Smallville.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so he seemed like a great guy to go with, and we got some traction with it. And in fact, even it was optioned actually by a studio that only wanted to take it off the market because they were afraid it would compete with something else they had planned.
Yeah.
And so we were kind of at a weird standstill. And then what happened was League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Now, I was unaware of the comic until a friend of mine told me about it, and I was like, oh, God, here we go. And I was absolutely terrified to see what Alan Moore had done.
Yeah.
And so I stayed away for a very long time, and then I wanted to see what he did with Nemo. And then I saw with the scimitar and the turban and all of that approach, and I said, well, okay, I'm not going there.
Right.
But I did go see the movie.
Yes.
And, of course, the movie, you know, the movie is the movie, but it did not do particularly well, as we know.
No.
And that wiped out any interest that anybody was going to have in my script.
I know, and it took Sean Carey out of the business, too. Damn it.
Yeah, it really, you know, people just didn't go see the film. And so we got the backlash. But then I met with a producer, good friend of mine, Amy Krell, who I'd known at USC. We meet years later, And she kind of made it her personal mission to try and get this thing made. Right. And we had so many close calls. And in fact, even if you Google it, there was a point when Hugh Bonneville was attached to play Captain Nemo, and Haley Atwell was our leading lady.
Right, wow.
And that, unfortunately, couldn't get the money together for that. And, you know, but what happened, Ken, is all during our process,
yeah,
all these giant remakes of 20,000 Leagues kept getting announced.
Wow, yeah.
David Fincher was going to do one. Sam Raimi was going to do one.
I mean,
on and on and on. And remember, yeah, then the one with Will Smith and Ridley, yeah, Scott's company and Bryan Singer.
Yeah.
And none of them ever happened.
I know, but it's been kicking around for a long time.
Long time, different scripts, different approaches, everything else.
Yeah.
So we kind of kept, you know, chugging along. We were making traction because people liked the script and what have you, but we never got to camera.
Right.
And I had a very good friend named Miles Swarthout, who actually wrote the screenplay to The Shootist, based on his dad's novel.
Right.
And Miles was a great friend of mine. He passed away about 2 years ago.
Right.
But he really pushed me hard to write Nemo Rising as a novel.
Right.
And I started on the shotguns. Those first two shotguns, by the way, the very first novels I ever wrote, I had never even attempted the form before.
Right.
So I was now published with those, thanks to Gary Goldstein and everybody at Pinnacle Books, and he was my editor there.
Right.
And I met a editor at a Western Writers Conference. And he got interested in the project because he thought it would be a movie tie-in.
Right.
So they read the script.
Okay.
And then the movie collapsed.
Oh.
So I had to call Tor Books, right, and tell them there was not going to be a film. Did they want to cancel the book?
Okay.
And they decided not to.
Oh, well, that's great. I'm glad they decided not,
yeah,
to.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And it took me about a year to write it.
Yeah.
And I was pretty, you know, insecure, and then since then I turned it in, and then the next thing I know, they gave us, you know, December 26th and a hardback release, and
awesome.
This, oh my God, it's the job and that cover and everything else is just absolutely gorgeous. I mean, they really have given us this tremendous first-class launch.
Yeah.
Just amazing. So yeah. It's really worked out beautifully, but of course that was all beyond my control. All I could do was, you know, jot it down and turn it in, but
yeah,
this is what it's become.
That's awesome. That's great. It's been
a long process.
You know what's going to happen now is it's going to get optioned now. Someone's going to read it this time around.
Yeah, well, I think we're pretty close to at least getting a pilot out of it, which would be wonderful.
Yeah.
I've always thought of this as television. I've always thought of this as Black Sails.
Okay, right. I get you. Yeah. That would be cool, too. I mean, because like you said, they've been trying to do this 20,000 Leagues for a long time, this movie. And I've followed it. I spoke to John Ottman, the composer/editor/everything else he does, end of last year. And I noticed that IMDb had gotten ahead of the game and decided to put him down that he was going to be the composer of this movie.
John was going to do the Bryan Singer, right?
Yeah, and I said to John, I said, do you know that you're going to do 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? And he said, well, I can't really talk about it, but he said, you know, they hear stuff and they put it up there. But that was sort of as far as I got with him because at that time, I think Brian was still, I don't know if Brian's still attached or not, but because John's his guy. As John said right back from the early days, he said, I won't make a film now unless you edit it and write the score. So you can always tell when Brian's getting ready to do another movie because John's getting ready to go back to hell, as he says. He said, it'd be all right if I just had to score the damn thing. But when I've got to score it and edit it, he said, you know, you might as well just find a dark room and leave me there for 6 months.
Well, you know, what always happens, I've been through this a few times and working on big projects, your odds get so diminished.
Yeah.
Because giant tentpole movies are so different. I've never had one launched. I mean, I've worked on a few things and of course they didn't happen.
Right.
And oh my God, there's so many things that have to happen, and the investment of money is so huge, and all of these you know, things, all these bits and pieces that just must fall into place, including having a filmmaker whose, you know, commercial reputation is so enormous that the studios relax about it. So I wanted to avoid that. I said, no, if this thing ever goes in front of camera, I still believe, and I hope that it does, certainly, but I still believe that television and long form is the way that it will actually finally appear. Because that's the way I always thought of it, and I think that's the best home.
Yeah, and I think so, too, to tell a deeper story sometimes. It's certainly a much better forum, because with a film, I mean, today's audiences are very, you know, they don't like to sit for too long. And if it's anything over sort of 2 hours or an hour and a half, they're getting fidgety and looking for the toilet, you know. So it's
but also too, it's like with looking at cable and streaming and everything else, it's like, my God, this is the home of Outlander and Game of Thrones and Da Vinci's Demons and Ripper Street and Peaky Blinders and on and on and on. I mean, this is the home of period action.
Yeah, and they're really getting back to what Hollywood used to do really well, and that was sort of great diversity.
Oh, I think so, absolutely. Yeah. So that's why I'm kind of have great hope there. I'm going to keep my fingers and toes crossed.
Oddly enough, a little bit of crossover I have with 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I was an extra. Did you ever see they did a version, TV film version, with Michael Caine as Captain Nemo?
Sure, absolutely, of course.
And they actually filmed some of that off Queensland, here where I live. There's the scene at the start of the film where they're all sort of, you know, the classic scene in the room where they're debating, oh, there's no sea monster and all that sort of stuff. I was actually an extra on that day of that particular shot. But I'm not in the shot, unfortunately, but my friend Jeff, who's an expat, American, came to Australia because he married an Australian girl, ended up coming over here. He used to be in the folk music sort of scene, and then he came over here, and oddly enough, he came to Australia and decided to become an actor, but which is not the best place to do it. but he's actually the one that got the show. I'm actually standing next to him when they cut it, or however they framed it. I'm actually, my shoulder is apparent next to Jeff, who's standing there behind one of the principals, sort of, you know, yelling, hey, hey. He doesn't really have a dialogue. He's just got to go, hey, hey, you know. But,
well, I have it on DVD, so I'm going to go, you know, frame grab your shoulder.
Yeah, so, when I watched it, I was like, oh, geez, wow. Okay, that's my arm. A piece of my arm. That's wonderful. I made the cut, literally.
Yeah, that version actually, I mean, the Ben Cross, Richard Crenna thing is just absolutely hideous.
Yeah.
But the version with Kane, it was so beautifully made.
Yes.
And had that great production value to it. And I thought that was really very nice. I thought Kane was wonderful. And everybody kind of, you know, I might have gone too far afield with this, but I think there is a reverence for that, you know, that work.
Yes.
That if you do a straight adaptation, of course, I did kind of a weird semi-sequel because I wanted to kind of be a little unshackled.
Right.
And have a different fun with it. Did you ever read Tarzan, the Lost Adventures, the book that Joe Lansdale ended up writing, finishing it for Edgar Rice Burroughs?
Yeah, totally. Yep. Awesome. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
And what I thought was so great was what Lansdale was able to do, and this was a constant, I held on to that thing like the Dead Sea Scrolls. I was constantly rereading it because I wanted to get into that mindset of the use of language and kind of rhythm that was going to be period and get that idea across and that attitude, but also, you know, was its own thing.
Right.
And that's really what I tried to do. Of course, you know, writing Westerns already, you're already in that era and it's the Civil War and everything, but it's tricky. It's vocabulary choice and it's inversion of words and how do you, you know, evoke the imagery you want to evoke, and yet still within that kind of delicacy of that time, because there's an expectation, I think, that people have when they read a story that's set in the 1800s. You want to respect that as well, even if you go beyond it just because it's an adventure story and, it's a pirate story.
Well, that was...
I mean, my God.
Yeah. Well, that was something that I was thinking about when I was writing the Hercules with a shotgun. You know, I was thinking about how do the Olympians talk and have them speak differently and noticeably different from the way other people speak. And so something came into my head about rhyme, like they talk in rhyme, like they have a rhyming cadence to the way that they address one another. And that was the way I went there, you know, to give
it a... Well, you know, that was something I did. Well, I used to, I love to do it in, I've done it a few times in shotgun and it is definitely a Nemo Rising, when you're dealing with, say, something like the crew of a sailing ship, and when you're dealing with guys who work on railroads or dig coal or whatever it is in the Old West, it was an international community, and you had people from Poland, and you had Germans. I mean, my God, there was a German-only speaking regiment in the Civil War.
Right.
So all of these things, these wonderful little grace notes that maybe people aren't completely aware of, I think they add so much color to when you write something from this era, and it also brings a different flavor to it. I think it also brings a different flavor to your writing, and it makes the characters more distinct.
Totally. And I mean, it's the same thing too when they make films about bush rangers over here, and Australians went to see them and go, oh, there's an awful lot of Irishmen, and it's true that we were essentially a penal colony, so there was a lot of Irish, there was a lot of Europeans, and a lot of the early bush rangers, Mad Dog Morgan and Ned Kelly were Irishmen. It might have been a bit of a stretch for cinematic audiences to see, you know, Dennis Hopper as an Irish-Australian bushranger.
Mad Dog Morgan.
Yeah, but I mean, no more than a stretch to see Sean Connery as a Spanish-Egyptian in Highlander.
Yes.
So, but I mean, so, you know, you've got to suspend disbelief, you know. And what a guy. He's been a Russian sub-captain as well. You know, he's unstoppable, Sean. But, you know.
Isn't there a movie that was made in the last year or so about Ned Kelly?
I'm not sure. The last one I recall was the Heath Ledger version. Sort of.
Maybe that's actually the one I was thinking of, because of course I go all the way back to Mick Jagger.
Yeah, Mick Jagger's one was good too. Yeah. He was, RoboCop in the 1800s. Yeah, no, I think Heath Ledger's was the last big screen version. They're always doing... Ned Kelly's kind of a staple. I got a good friend who's doing a comic book coming out real soon as well, like your book, that is essentially a future where zombies have created a society because they've now garnered intelligence. So it's like Planet of the Apes, but it's Planet of the Zombies, so to speak.
Oh, that's neat.
And there's a pocket of resistance left, and they're led by this freedom fighter, and he's a man called Ned. And, of course, it's basically Ned Kelly retooled for a Mad Maxian dystopian apocalyptic future. And he's the defender and savior of the last pocket of humanity. And the book's simply called I Am Ned. But
I love that.
Yeah, I'll send you a link to that, and you can check that out if you like. It's really, really cool stuff. It's taken the iconography and sort of molded it with some of the things that are trendy today, like zombies and The Walking Dead, and of course we're the land that invented Mad Max, so it's got a bit of Mad Max in it, and it's got a great. I mean, it's definitely got a movie written all over there at some point. I certainly hope the best for these young fellas.
One of the things that's happened was certainly as Tor has sent out the cover to Nemo Rising, which again I think they did a spectacular job with it.
Beautiful. Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
But you know, this is the thing, because I have my the sea monsters and the things that are in there. Some of them are machines.
Right.
And of course, that's what you see there on the front is a mechanical octopus.
Right.
I guess this is now considered steampunk.
Yes, yes.
And I'm kind of an unlikely steampunk author, I think.
Right.
I'm sitting around here, you know, watching Lee Marvin movies and Ron Chaney Jr. Inner Sanctum films from the 40s.
Right.
And it's like, oh my gosh, I never really get. But of course, that the whole steampunk bent really is, it's the Industrial Revolution. And of course, that is the actual time when these novels were originally written.
Yeah. And I mean, okay, a lot of stuff with steampunk has got to do with retrofitting, like literally taking, you know, retro or classical, you know, steam-driven technology and reapplying it to sort of very, very similar to the way science fiction works with retrofitted science fiction. So it's almost the old school version of that. So, but yeah, but no, I think it's a great concept. It's certainly a different way to go for a sequel. I mean, because people's touch, I don't know about you, my touchstone is always the James Mason movie. I don't think they've made one better. I don't know if they ever will, because that was just that's just a great film. Certainly a milestone in movies. It's got a great cast. Wonderful the way it was put together. It's even got a musical number. Got a whale of a tale.
Oh, a whale of a tale. A
whale of a tale to tell you, lad. A whale of a tale or two. And Mason, I'm a huge James Mason fan, so it was wonderful to see him in that part. I love that scene. One of my favorite scenes ever in movies is when he's playing the organ. And there's so much pain, like he's looking at himself in the mirror, there's so much pain on his face and longing and regret. And then he hears the bell, like, because there's another ship coming. And you just watch great actors. It's been said before by other commentators other than myself, but they say a great actor puts it in his eyes, right? They don't have to really say anything because they'll put it in the eyes. De Niro can do it too. There's a few actors that can do it. Not many actors can do it. But you watch.
Well, you know,
Also
with the image of Mason, and again, I do think that they very much wanted, if you will, kind of the U-boat commander appearance because of when the movie was made, shortly after. You know, the end of World War II, and with the turtlenecks and all of that stuff.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
When the idea came up of the way that I thought Nemo should be visualized,
yes.
Of course, this thing with using a scimitar and his background from India.
Yes.
And I said, no, let's not go that way. First of all, I think now a lot of people have adapted that look. So I was kind of resistant to it. But also, it's like, no, you know, this is the thing. And Mason, at least, he emphasizes this. And it's very much, you know, a part of Jules Verne's text.
Yeah.
The name means no one.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. Nemo is truly the man without a country. So, and he doesn't want a country. So there can't be really a cultural identity attached to it.
That's true, yeah, yeah.
Because he rejects it.
Yeah, totally, totally. That's why he's gone the way he has. You know, he says...
Absolutely, yes.
Many times in the film he says, you know, I've left that world behind. So, you know, he's...
Because he lost his wife and his son to a cultural war.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, I love that scene because right near the end, when he hears that thing, he's still playing the organ. You watch his eyes change. You know, he goes from this man full of pain and sadness and longing and regret, and his eyes just go dark. And it's time to kill. You know, and it's just beautiful. They don't make movies like that.
Well, when's the last time you watched Cross of Iron?
Oh, Cross of Iron. Actually, you know, I watched that like a couple of weeks ago, actually.
To see those scenes, and I had Sam Peckinpah, oh my God, that was just me sitting back and enjoying myself.
Yeah.
Because to see these scenes with Mason and Max Schell and David Warner, it's like, oh my God, it's just glorious.
Yeah.
Because those guys could so completely inhabit what they were doing.
Yeah.
and bring forth this charisma.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Just absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And of course, as Mason, I think I may be wrong, but I think he probably worked with Sidney Lumet more than any other director.
Yeah.
No. I think they did 5 or 6 movies together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, he was no longer a leading man. He was a character star.
Yeah.
And oh my God. To see the verdict and Murder on the Orient Express and The Deadly Affair and he's just remarkable.
Yeah.
And then you go back to something that's so, when you talk about pain, what he did in A Star Is Born is just
Well, that's a very monumental part too. I even love him in one of his latter parts was in the Salem Toby Hooper's Salem's Lot where he plays Straker.
Oh, he's great in Salem's Lot.
You know, he's got that. You know, fool. You can't kill the master. You know, you know. He plays that. The how shall we say the vampire's assistant very well.
What is that wonderful movie he did with Helen Mirren where she's she's posing naked for him? For the painter.
Oh, yeah, I know the one you're talking about.
It's such an interesting film because you would think it would have this big kind of lascivious aspect to it, despite, you know, she's very much on display and looks tremendous. But it's not. It really is, you know, they have this amazing kind of innocent relationship going on.
Yeah.
And he really just went, boy, he just captured it. He really just wants to paint her.
Yeah.
And wants her to find a guy, a young guy her own age, and go off and have her happy life. And that's a wonderful movie.
Yeah.
And boy, he could really nail it.
Yeah. No, I could talk to you for a couple of hours about James Mason. But you've already been very generous with your time, Courtney, this morning. I'll have to get your postal address off you because I've got a copy of Hercules with a Shotgun that's been burning a hole in my pocket. So we might trade books, hey? I'll sign mine if you'll sign yours.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Because I'm very, very keen to read Nemo Rising. It certainly sounds like a great, as you say, rollicking adventure. The long-awaited sequel to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Well, somebody asked me to describe it. And I said, well, think of Alistair MacLean getting really, really drunk.
Right.
And then writing a sequel to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And I think that kind of sums it up pretty well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at least he's not, you know, it's not Jack Sparrow meets, you know, Jack Sparrow steals the Nautilus or something like that. while we're talking about the Nautilus, just briefly, there's been the many iterations of that ship. I mean, to me, it sort of bordered on the ridiculous in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I mean, it was huge. You know, like almost a giant sword in the water. You know, but and of course in the Disney film it was very robust and very, very much of that. We talk about steampunk. That.
Well, of course, Harper Goff's design became so iconic.
Yeah. But I mean,
In fact, they ended up being trademarked.
Yeah. And I mean, with you, when you were sort of writing and visualizing the Nautilus, were you thinking Disney, or were you going your own way?
Well, the thing was, I of course, it would be impossible not to be influenced by what Harper Goff created,
right.
Because he also was looking at the Monitor and the Merrimack and the Ironclads of the Civil War.
Totally.
Because there was submarine technology then.
Yes.
And so he was bouncing from that. Of course, the Nautilus is the astonishing, you know, improvement over those. But he used that, and that's, so I wanted to go the same way. Of course, there are certain things, including an organ, and, you know, but I, one of the things that I thought would be wonderful is, because they have to basically rebuild the submarine, because it's been so damaged by cannon fire, and the Navy's taken it apart and tried to figure it out and what have you. So they, the young lady, who is the daughter of the
chief advisor,
the vice president, who is really the fellow in charge under Grant, and she is the one who actually puts it back together, Sarah. And I wanted to get into not just the idea of the Disney design and what have you, but also to the realities of the way ironclads were built, but you also have your flight of fancy, and of course, Vern did describe it as the saber of the ocean.
Yes.
But that becomes more like the Nautilus submarines of the 1960s.
Yes.
And that just wasn't appropriate, and it's certainly not age appropriate.
Yes.
But it was always I think that. To keep it right for the period and everything else, you have to go for the iron plating, the rivets, the giant viewports, and all of that stuff. Because it's also right for the time period, and it's also, I think, right emotionally, if you will, for anybody who's going to read it.
Well, it's certainly
it feels like the Nautilus, you know.
Well, I'm certainly one of the people that wants to read it, Courtney, and it's been absolutely a pleasure to talk to you. We've gone probably a little bit over time, but that's what happens when two guys who love movies get to talking.
I apologize for that, Ed, but thank you
much. It's been really great.
This was great fun.
That will be a real treat, ladies and gentlemen. Nemo Rising coming out on December 26th. Beautiful hardcover edition. It looks tremendous. It looks the business. See Courtney Joyner behind the words. It'll certainly will deliver. No doubt there.